Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractors Business CD of the Month. This monthly CD web series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of teaching contractors how to run profitable businesses. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry shares dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. We may all have our own opinions of laws and lawyers, but guess what? Without either, we'd be in real trouble. This month's presentation may not be the most entertaining you've ever listened to, but it is one of the most important. When it comes to hiring, supervising, and terminating employees, each of us had better do it right, or we could find ourselves in real trouble. When it comes to law, we should also be sure that the information is coming from someone who is highly knowledgeable about what each contractor may or may not do. This month, Lewis Clark is our presenter. Lewis is a trial lawyer who represents employers in a broad range of employment litigation and administrative matters throughout the United States that involve such issues as discrimination, harassment, retaliation, wage and hour, employment at will, employee benefits, employment contracts, defamation, employment intentional torts, wrongful discharge, unfair competition, trade secrets and unfair labor practices. He also regularly represents both private and public sector employers in arbitrations relating to grievances under collective bargaining agreements. Mr. Clark counsels employers on compliance with all federal and state labor and employment laws, such as all federal and state discrimination laws, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Family and Medical Leave Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, the Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act, WARN, the Equal Pay Act, the National Labor Relations Act, the Whistleblower Retaliation Provisions of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act, USERRA. He also counsels employers on workplace harassment, workplace violence, terminations, massive layoffs, union avoidance, unfair labor practices, drug and alcohol testing, employment practices liability insurance, employee handbook and policies, non-competition agreements, and executive employment agreements. He regularly collaborates with the firm's corporate lawyers, counseling clients on employment and traditional labor law issues that arise amidst mergers, acquisitions, bankruptcies, and reorganizations. Mr. Clark also performs comprehensive reviews of employers' employment policies and practices and performs training for supervisors and other employees concerning hiring and firing, discrimination, harassment, management employee leaves, religious discrimination and accommodation, union avoidance, and other employee relations issues. He also is a frequent lecturer for a variety of human resource organizations and serves as an appointed mediator for the United States District Court for the Southern District of Ohio. Mr. Clark is a member of the American Bar Association, the Ohio and New York State Bar Associations, and the Columbus Bar Association, and is a member of the Labor and Employment Committee of those bar associations. He's listed in the 2006-2007 editions of the Best Lawyers in America, Chambers USA, America's Leading Lawyers 2006, and is noted as a 2007 Ohio Super Lawyer. By this time, you should have gotten the point. Lewis knows what he's talking about. Now, let's set a few minutes aside and listen to some things that will affect how you hire, supervise, and terminate employees. This presentation could very well save you a lot of money in the future in terms of lawsuits.
Hello, I'm Lou Clark, a labor and employment attorney with Squire Sanders and Dempsey. Today, I will be addressing a variety of issues that employers need to be aware of throughout the hiring, supervision, and termination of employees. First, I'll speak to the numerous federal and state discrimination statutes that are the principal sorts of regulation for the hiring process. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and various state statutes together prohibit discrimination in recruiting and hiring on the basis of race, color, gender, national origin, age, religion, and disability. It's important to note that in addition to these federal laws, many states and communities have local laws that provide protection based on other classifications, such as sexual orientation, for example. California law protects people based upon their gender identity, and there's a Kentucky law that protects individuals based upon whether they are smokers or non-smokers. Employers must use care to avoid discriminatory inquiries in the application and interview process. In general, employers may not seek information for the purpose of determining if an applicant is in a protected class or information which otherwise could be used to discriminate. Certainly, it's improper to ask about the applicant's race, age, sex, religion, disability, or national origin. Similarly, inquiries about child-rearing plans, pregnancy, children, or marital status are likely to be considered discriminatory. Although an employer cannot ask about the existence, nature, or severity of a disability, an employer may ask about an applicant's ability to perform specific job-related functions. An acceptable question would be an applicant's ability to lift 50 pounds, for example, if the job involved that kind of lifting. Interview questions should be neutral and business-related, sticking to questions about the employee's work experience, ability to perform the job at hand, or the employee's interest in the company itself. Employers also must be careful not to write comments on resumes, interview evaluation forms, or make any other notes or comments that might be interpreted as illegal, discriminatory, or defamatory, since all of these would be discoverable if a lawsuit were to arise about the employee's employment or the failure to be hired. In general, applications or other new hire documentation should elicit the following job-related information. Number one, basic information such as an applicant's name, address, phone number, and date of application. Number two, education including schools attended, degrees, highest year completed if no degree was obtained, and the number of years attended, but not dates attended, because that could be used to determine an applicant's age. Number three, employment history, including all prior employers, dates of employment, specific jobs, compensation, and the reasons for leaving. Number four, other job-related qualifications, which may include applicable licenses, certifications, special training, and job-specific skills. Number five, the position for which application is made. Number six, a question asking if the applicant is authorized to work in the United States, with a note indicating that I-9 information will be required at the time of employment. Number seven, criminal convictions, although the application should note that a conviction is not automatically disqualifying. Number eight, references, along with an authorization to check references to obtain information from prior employers. Number nine, a statement that the employer is an equal opportunity employer. Also a statement that the employment will be at will. It's also important to include a certification by the applicant that the truth of all statements made on the application and notification to the applicant that false statements or material omissions may be grounds for discharge. And finally, it's important to have a notification that an offer for employment may be contingent upon successful completion of a physical examination or a drug and alcohol screening if your company uses those. Just as prospective employers can cause problems by saying or asking too much, so too can they get in trouble if they fail to thoroughly check on an applicant. Negligent hiring claims are uncommon, but they have been recognized in most states. Negligent hiring claims may arise if the employer knew or should have known at the time of hiring of the employee's specific unfitness for the job, and that this unfitness would create a hazard to third persons, and finally that the specific problem was the cause of injury claimed by an individual bringing a lawsuit. A thorough inquiry into a potential employee's references will help raise a red flag if the former employee mentions any specific trouble with the employee. Additionally, the employee's references provide useful insights into the employee's capabilities, experience level, responsibility, and interpersonal abilities. Be sure to ask pointed questions to get as much information as possible. Do not simply ask about an employee's strengths, but also ask about the employee's weaknesses or areas for improvement. Another important area of the law that employers must comply with when hiring employees is the various immigration laws. Immigration laws are currently in a state of flux, and the U.S. government has become significantly more active in enforcing immigration laws against employers. The Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, through its Immigration and Customs Enforcement Division, or ICE, has been active in enforcing the existing laws. Additionally, the U.S. government has implemented increasingly drastic security measures and electronic initiatives to address emergent national security concerns. This increase in the government's tracking capabilities is manifesting itself in a resurgence of government audits and criminal investigations of U.S. employers. It's not surprising that ICE has focused on holding employers civilly and criminally liable for hiring illegal workers. Further government search warrants, worksite raids, and audits have become standard investigative tools to assist in the enforcement of U.S. immigration laws. Because illegal immigration has become an ever-increasing problem, employers need to be vigilant at ensuring that all workers are able to legally work in the United States and have proper documentation. The Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986 requires employers to complete a Form I-9 for all new employees. Section 1 of the form must be completed by the employee on or before the first day of paid work. It's the responsibility of the employer to review and ensure that the employee fully completes Section 1, although the employer is not responsible if the employee misrepresents information. Section 2 must be completed by the employer within 3 business days of the date of hire. The employee must present an original document or documents that establish both identity and employment eligibility. Employees, not employers, may choose which documents they want to present from the lists of acceptable documents. Employers may accept any valid document or combination of documents as contained on the list of acceptable documents on the reverse side of the I-9 until the form is revised. Acceptable documents include a U.S. passport or a driver's license or a U.S. Social Security card. An employer must examine the original documents presented by the employee and complete the relevant information about the documentation on Section 2 of the I-9. Employers must accept any document that appears on its face to be genuine and related to the person presenting it. Although it's not required, employers may photocopy the front and back of the original documentation and retain the copies with the I-9. It's important to establish a consistent policy with regard to copying documents. Retaining copies of some employees' documents, while not others, could lead to a claim of immigration discrimination. Additionally, each year the Social Security Administration sends employers correction requests, also known as no-match letters, to thousands of U.S. employers. Given the frenzy over immigration our country is now experiencing and governmental immigration compliance audits and investigations, employers responding to no-match letters might be tempted to hastily ask for new documents or even terminate workers who cannot produce a new Social Security card. Employers should not treat a no-match letter as notification of an immigration violation, but should seriously consider the consequences of not dealing with it properly. Before responding rashly and risking violations of other federal and state laws, employers need to understand that no-match letters are still requests for corrections, but they must follow certain steps to ensure they discharge their legal obligation properly. The Social Security Administration has no ability to penalize employers for supplying incorrect Social Security number information or for failing to respond to a no-match letter, but the Social Security Administration can, however, provide no-match information to the IRS and to the DHS. The IRS can investigate, audit, and ultimately fine an employer based upon information provided by the Social Security Administration. Employers may be able to avoid liability for purposes of the Internal Revenue Code if the failure to comply was due to reasonable cause. The following is an example of a process based on the current law that could be followed to establish reasonable cause and avoid other potential liability in the context of Social Security number no-match letters. First, if you receive a no-match letter, check your records for a discrepancy in recording the information by comparing the employee's W-4s to the number reported to the Social Security Administration. An employer can also informally ask those employees to present their Social Security numbers and correct the record or the W-4s as the case may be. Next, if the numbers still do not match, the employer should provide notice to the affected employees or former employees at their last known address. The notice should provide that their names and numbers do not match with the Social Security Administration records and request that they correct the discrepancies at a Social Security Administration office and then advise the employer of the result. All information reported back by employees should be used to correct the employer's records and report back to the Social Security Administration. If discrepancies persist or employees or former employees do not report back to the employer must follow the next step. At the end of the current tax year, the employer should re-notify non-responding employees and former employees. Again, the employer should send a formal notice. Finally, the employer should send yet another notice at the end of the next tax year. The language in this notice should be the same as before, but also indicate that the employer has previously sent notice to the employee or former employee. For many employers, the crucial thing is to know the minimum steps it must take and when to take them to satisfy the IRS requirement to show reasonable cause for not providing the correct employee Social Security number or name information on a wage report. Another timely topic employers must consider is the use of background checks to screen potential employees. In addition to criminal background checks, employers may want to obtain a credit report for a potential employee. The use of credit reports is restricted by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which governs both credit checks and investigative background checks, which can include criminal background checks. It covers consumer reports, which include any information provided by a consumer reporting agency addressing creditworthiness, character, reputation, or personal characteristics, and lifestyle. It also contains a separate provision for investigative consumer reports, which are those consumer reports obtaining information through personal interviews. An employer ordering either a consumer report or investigative consumer report on an applicant must give the individual a written statement disclosing that the report may be obtained and secure a written authorization and release from the applicant. For investigative consumer reports, the employer also must advise the individual of the right to disclosure of the nature and scope of the investigation and provide a copy of the Summary of Your Rights under the Fair Credit Reporting Act document. In addition, action cannot be taken against an applicant based upon a consumer report until the individual is given a copy of the report and a written description of his or her rights under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. After providing these documents to the employer must wait approximately 5 days before proceeding with any action. After taking action, the employer must give the applicant notice of the action, the name, address, and phone number of the consumer reporting agency, a statement that the agency did not make and cannot provide reasons for the employer's decision, and notice of the applicant's right to obtain a copy of the report from the agency and to dispute the accuracy of the information in it. Background checks are becoming an ever important tool for the employer during the hiring process. Because it is often not viable to conduct thorough checks independently, employers can gather information from many screening companies through the National Association of Professional Background Screeners, which provides information to the employer detailing the screening procedures used by its members. In today's ever-increasing reliance on the Internet, many employers are also doing internet searches to find any websites, MySpace pages, YouTube videos, and the like of potential employees. While these searches can be useful, employers must be cautious not to make a hiring decision based upon information from a website that could be seen as discriminatory. Next, I'll turn to matters employers should consider in their supervision of employees. Most people dislike conflict and difficult conversations. Many supervisors and human resource managers fail to address performance problems and small work-related issues, hoping they'll just go away. However, like most things in life, performance issues and personnel problems do not just go away by themselves. Instead, some amount of attention must be paid to these issues. Employers should document and counsel employees regarding performance issues. Employers can't wait until termination to tell an employee about poor job performance. If the employer never informs an employee of a problem, the employer creates a history that the employee's behavior is acceptable. Employers should list any performance or behavior problems on an employee's performance evaluation. If a problem employee gives good evaluations and is subsequently terminated, the good performance evaluation could be evidence in the employee's favor in a wrongful termination claim. All problems should be listed on the employee's performance evaluation, explained to the employee, and the employee should sign the evaluation to acknowledge that they've gotten notice of the problem. The performance evaluation should then be placed in the employee's personnel file. It's also very important that all supervisors be informed of the employer's policies and procedures and the importance of uniform and consistent enforcement. To help prevent many issues from arising in the first place, employers must educate employees regarding company policies and procedures. A complete employee handbook can be a valuable tool in effectively communicating company policies to employees. Another supervisory mistake employers make is failing to conduct a proper and adequate investigation, which can be fatal to employers in litigation. Employers should have a policy regarding investigations of workplace misconduct, and such policies should be followed promptly and consistently each time an employee brings a good faith complaint that it witnessed or was the subject of perceived unlawful conduct. Even anonymous complaints of workplace wrongdoing should be taken seriously. Although most employers would agree that the prospect of conducting a workplace investigation is not pleasurable, there can be many benefits to the employer that may result from such an investigation. Some examples of how conducting a sound workplace investigation may benefit the employer include the following. An investigation may give the employer an opportunity to remedy festering problems that may not otherwise have come to the attention of the employer absent the employee grievance. For example, if an employee reports harassing behavior from another employee, a workplace investigation may prevent the problem from becoming a pattern, which would have potentially exposed the employer to increased liability. An investigation may also help to enforce company policies. A good workplace investigation will let your employees know that there are consequences to breaking company policies. In turn, such an investigation may deter future employee misconduct. Further, an investigation may encourage early reporting of employee grievances. If employees take notice that a workplace investigation will be promptly initiated for an employee grievance, other employees may be more willing to discuss future grievances with the employer before seeking outside legal remedies. Therefore, potential litigation, which otherwise may have been brought by an aggrieved employee, may be avoided. Finally, a proper workplace investigation can help avoid or minimize employer liability. For example, when an employer fails to conduct a proper investigation, ratification or approval of the improper acts can be inferred from the fact that the employer, after being informed of the employee's actions, didn't fully investigate or failed to correct the employee's conduct. Similarly, a failure to investigate can create an inference of pretext, malice, or retaliation, especially when an employer has an internal policy to investigate complaints or has investigated other employee claims. The employer will be forced to explain why an investigation was not conducted in that particular instance. Now, after an adequate investigation and when appropriate, the employer should take corrective action if it finds wrongdoing. Taking corrective action both enforces the employer's policies and provides a layer of protection to an employer in litigation. However, while a properly performed workplace investigation can help an employer and prevent liability, a poorly conducted investigation can compromise a possible defense. Some common mistakes employers make when conducting a workplace investigation include delaying the start of an investigation, waiting too long, selecting an investigator who is biased or who's perceived as biased, failing to interview the employee who's complaining or some other important witness. Another mistake is guaranteeing absolute confidentiality. Another mistake can be failing to maintain some confidentiality of the conversation. Another mistake is failing to listen to witnesses or to document interviews. Another mistake is threatening, coercing, or intimidating witnesses. Another mistake is failing to complete the investigation promptly, waiting too long to finish the investigation. Another mistake can be failing to provide the complaining employee or a witness to protect them from retaliation. And finally, failing to take appropriate disciplinary action. Also, there are many potential pitfalls when terminating employees. Many employers fail to take adequate preparation prior to a termination. Although in most states, employers do not have to provide a reason for terminating an employee's employment, in the event that the employer is required to defend the termination decision in the future, it should ensure that it has legitimate and well-documented reasons for terminating an employee. And I do recommend that employers provide the terminated employee with a cogent, concise reason for the termination. A legitimate termination decision should never be based upon any discriminatory reason or in retaliation to an employee making a complaint. An employee could be protected based upon race, sex, religion, an ethnic group, national origin, ancestry, engaging in union organizing, disability, marital status, pregnancy or childbirth, age, if the employee is at least 40 years old, their veteran status, their military status, making safety complaints, filing a workers' compensation claim, making a sexual harassment claim, engaging in jury duty, making a prior discrimination claim, or being on FMLA leave. However, it is possible to terminate an employee in a protected class for a legitimate, justified, non-discriminatory, non-retaliatory reason. Before terminating an employee, an employer will want to ensure that if the employee is treated differently, the reasons are demonstrably legitimate from a business standpoint, and that the timing is sufficiently separated from any protected event to remove the risk that the termination could be tainted. Again, the legitimate reason should be well documented and placed in the employee's personnel file. Also, if the employee has a written employment contract, the employer must follow the terms of the contract, including any notice provisions or severance agreements. For employees without written contracts, the employer will want to follow all procedures laid out in the employee handbook, if one exists, or in any other published policies or work rules. Employer policies could include a progressive discipline system, where an employer must give an employee oral or written notice of the problem and a chance to fix the problem. If an employer utilizes progressive discipline, the employer should set a deadline for the employee to correct the problem, warn the employee that the termination is imminent if the problem is not corrected, and then document any oral warning for the employee's personnel file. Then, when terminating the employee's employment, it may be desirable for the employer to give severance pay in exchange for a release of liability from the employee. Especially if the employee is at least 40 years old, a release should include provisions advising in writing that the employee should consult with an attorney and giving the employee at least 21 days to consider the release and at least 7 days to revoke the release after they've signed it. Before offering any severance package, the employer should determine if they are prepared to negotiate, and if so, what their bottom line position is. Also, if the employee signed a non-compete agreement, a non-solicitation agreement, or a non-disclosure agreement, the employer will want to remind the employee of his or her obligations under the agreement and give the employee a copy of the signed agreement. Also, when terminating an employee, the employer should be brief, make it clear that the decision is final. The employee should not be allowed to argue or dispute the reason for the termination or engage in a lengthy discussion about that. Also, an employer should always have an additional supervisor present, or if possible, someone from human resources who would be experienced at dealing with the emotions that can come from with a termination. The employer should always try to be sensitive to the employee and inform the employee in private at a good time of day. Always treat the terminated employee with dignity and respect, and do it in a way that the employee's dignity can be preserved. The employer should always also be prepared to explain the employee's final pay, accrued unused vacation, a COBRA, a standard employment reference, retirement plan benefits, medical benefits, other benefit plan entitlements, the exact date and manner of departure, and the employer should recover any employer property, including keys, tools, an identification badge, and the like. As a practical matter, the employer may also want to have boxes ready so that the terminated employee may pack any personal items. Hopefully by following these hiring, supervision, and termination guidelines, you will avoid potential lawsuits and employ the best possible workers for your company. Thank you.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's presentation. Feel free to give us a call with your comments, or if you prefer, you may fax or email our office. You're already aware of our 3-day basic business boot camps and Service Managers University programs, but something new has been added. You can now attend free webinars on both programs. Each 20-minute webinar is held every other week. To join a session, you simply call our office at 1-800-432-7963, or you can go to our website at www.grandyassociates.com. The website lists the dates and the times, and you can register to attend right online. Come listen and learn. You'll be glad you did. For more information on our 3-day basic business boot camps or Service Managers University, simply call Grandy & Associates at 1-800-432-7963 or check us out on the web. Again, the address is www.grandyassociates.com. A small investment in training can produce big profits. The Service Contractors Business CD of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service, just give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.